Isms chattered back and forth, snouts clacking, stabbing tongues flicking out between needle teeth as they advanced carefully into this new, unknown location. The smell of them was rank and sickening. Crouching against the wall on the walkway ring behind the men guarding her, Kiss stared up at the prowling creatures in disgust and involuntary fear. Some of the bounty hunters around Vorna began backing away. Even Vorna had come to a halt, halfway up the steps.
Doran, Kixo,
Vorna hissed.
Get up there and take those ugly sons of bitches down.
The two men chosen advanced nervously up the steps onto the upper platform, carbines raised. The creatures stopped in their tracks and seemed to observe the slowly approaching men with curiosity.
Got a clean shot on the first,
one of the cautious bounty hunters muttered, aiming his carbine from the shoulder.
Get ready to take the other.
The nearest of the monsters turned, regarded him with a tilt of its head, and pounced with an abrupt, effortless spring of its hind legs. The bounty hunter was brought down under its weight, his carbine firing uselessly into the roof. It had him pinned for an instant, face up on the deck. He began to scream. Its four hook limbs flicked out and snapped down like shears, quartering him like a portioned game bird. The entire kill had taken barely a second. With an anguished howl, the other man opened fire, blasting the predator off his colleague's messy corpse. The shots blew its torso open in a spatter of purple, sticky sap and knocked it clean off the platform. The second monster yapped like a feral dog and sprang at the shooter. All of the other bounty hunters opened fire instinctively, shooting from their positions on the raised walkway and the upper steps. The broadside of frantic shots shredded the thing in mid-air. They also slew its intended prey. The bounty hunter toppled forward in a mist of blood.
Cease fire! Vorna yelled. Cease fire, you dumb friggers! You just wasted Kixo!
His spooked men were no longer listening to him. A few were backing towards the exits. The rest were training their weapons at the open door. Horned black snouts came snuffling out of the red light. Drooling teeth chittered. A dozen more of the black and white things sprang through the doorway into the chamber. Then a dozen more, bouncing and jumping. All hell broke loose. Vorna's men began blasting indiscriminately. The red glow of the burning chamber lit up with a shower of bright white lasbolts. Gleaming alien bodies ruptured and fell, thrashing in death agonies, but there were too many of them. The chittering predators, agile and shockingly fast, plowed forwards into the men, cutting them apart. The shooting turned to screaming. Those of Vorna's men that could broke and ran.
Stand your frigging ground!
Vorna bellowed from the upper steps. He turned in time to see one of the black and white horrors launching itself at him. Lucius Vorna didn't flinch. He met its attack with his chainsword and cut it in half. It was not a clean kill. The creature's limbs were still flailing and stabbing wildly, and it crashed into him, throwing him backwards down the steps. The men guarding Kiss had fled. She rose, fighting the urge to follow them. She had to find Nail. She had to see if Ravenna would return, although if these things were gathered on the far side of the door, she didn't hold out much hope of that happening. She ran towards the huddled, moaning housekeepers. Behind her, Vorna's men were blasting and dying.
Move, she yelled at the housekeepers. Get out of here!
None of them stirred. They rocked and mumbled.
You idiots,
she cried. Something slammed her into the wall. One of Vorna's bruisers had shoved her aside in his effort to escape. A black-and-white shape landed directly on his back. He grunted as he was flattened, face down beneath it. It quickly snipped off his arms and head. Kiss heard and smelled the torrent of human blood emptying down through the grilled walkway decking from the butchered corpse. She rose slowly into a crouch, edging her kind blades out. The long metal blades came free from her bodice and floated up on either side of her face, pointing forward, suspended by her telekinetic impulse. The monster calmly bent down and nipped meat from the corpse with a delicate snap of its teeth. She saw the glossy blackness of its upper armor, scribbled with lines of old scars, the waxy whiteness of its lower body, where patches of threadworm parasites clustered. She could smell the metallic hormone stench of it and feel its presence scratching against her mind. It raised its head slowly and turned its horned snout towards Kiss. Its eyes were awful, lifeless slits above a rictus grin. Rivulets of bright human blood dribbled down its gleaming, bone-white chin and dripped onto the walkway. It chittered, its mouth snapping and chattering, tongue stabbing. Tasting, sensing, smelling all at once. Throat sacs under its chin pulsed and swelled. Its powerful legs tensed, and it sprang towards her. Kiss rolled furiously. Her paired kind blades met the pouncing thing in mid-air, punching clean through it like high-velocity rounds. She'd aimed for the throat sacs, the softest, least armored part of it. The sacs burst as the blades punctured them, and yellow fluid sprayed out. Chitinous dorsal plates cracked a nanosecond later, as the exiting blades blew out of the monster's back in foggy sprays. The kinetic shock stopped it short, mid-pounce, and dropped it onto the walkway beside her. It writhed, snapping at her, tail curling and flopping, its hook limbs thrashing. Then, the entire walkway section it lay on fell away, eaten to pulp by the bio-acid that had poured out of its throat sacs. It crashed down onto the theater floor space below. Kiss leapt to her feet, summoning her kind blades back. There was nothing left of them. They had been reduced to spurs of dissolving metal by the corrosive contents of the throat sacs. Kiss let them fall. The hairs on her neck rose. She turned, very, very slowly. Head down, yapping softly, another of the things stepped towards her along the walkway. Chapter 3. The house shook and staggered. There was an echoing boom from above them, and then another. Plyton was thrown off her perch. She landed hard on the dock's decking and rolled several times. She almost pitched off into the water. "What the hell was that?" Lusick was demanding, ripping out his link. Burnface had been thrown onto the deck, too. He got up, angry.
"Give me that," he snarled.
Her arms shaking, Plyton pulled herself up. Down in the dock pool, the water was slopping feverishly. The underboat was straining at its chains, bucking in the icy froth. The chains creaked and pulled. The house shook again, a deep, ugly lurch, and the boat bucked more furiously. The hanging chains swished and shook. Ice crackled down into the washing swell.
"Vona! Vona!"
Burnface yelled into the link. There was no response.
"Vona!"
Plyton plowed into them both from behind. Lusick fell and hit his head against a fuel drum. Burnface tried to turn, but she slammed her fist into the side of his head repeatedly. They landed hard. The bounty hunter's carbine hit the decking and slithered out of reach. He rolled, tucked his legs up, and savagely kicked her in the torso with both feet. Winded, gasping, Plyton flew backwards through the air. She smashed into some of the dangling chains and managed to grab one. She was still traveling. Momentum turned her into a pendulum. Hanging from the chain, she soared out over the pool. Thrashing ice water sloshed 10 meters below her. Plyton clung on. The chain swung her back over the dock. Burnface had rolled onto his knees, and she kicked out at him, but missed as she swung past. He was reaching for the fallen carbine. She swung back, missing him again, dangling out above the churning pool at the extremity of her backswing. Her hands had locked up, turned to aching numbness by the touch of the chain loops. She swung in for a second time. Burnface had risen, dodging her sweeping form as it came in. He rolled hard and came up with her transvasor in his hands as she swept back again. He grinned as he fired it at her. The weapon dry-clicked. He hadn't reloaded it since stripping it down. She swung past him, her momentum diminishing. Then the house staggered again and wrenched her around furiously, jerking her up over the pool with such violence her chain became slack for a second. Burnface rolled again, diving for the fallen carbine. She sailed down at him and struck him hard. Plyton viced her dangling legs around him and carried him on with her. Burnface smashed headfirst into an oil drum. He fell away from her, his neck snapped, and slammed onto the dock. Plyton let go of the chain and fell hard. Dazed, she rose and glanced around. Burnface's corpse lay face down on the grilled deck. Lusick had vanished. She stumbled forward and picked up the bounty hunter's las carbine. The house shook again. It listed badly to one side, and she fell onto the sloping deck. With a gunshot bang, one of the chains mooring the underboat broke. Its prow swung around in the frothing pool. "Lusick!" she yelled. Lusick had run down the service tunnel into the drum chamber. The cargo hoist was still up. He gathered Plyton's shotgun to his chest. Weird echoes rang down the riser shaft. Was that gunfire? Shouting? Lucic strode towards the spiral staircase, coping with the relentless, sickening roll and shift of the deck. He started up the stairs and reached the roof hatch. He pulled the inset handle, and it swung down. He looked up into the dark shaft above. The creature lunged at Kiss. She met it with her kind force and hurled it away from her along the walkway. That took effort. The creature was strong, vital, bristling with energy, and its chitinous structure was as hard as steel. It landed in an ungainly sprawl, powerful hind limbs skidding and scrabbling for purchase. It sprang up again, undeterred, and charged back towards her. Kiss turned and leapt across the gaping walkway section that the acid had removed. She landed beside the dead bounty hunter, held out her hand, and his fallen carbine flew from the deck into her grasp. She turned back and blew the bounding creature in half. The whole chamber was on fire. The house shuddered and realigned, wounded and dying. Predatory shapes, tails high, leapt through the smoke and flames, dismembering the last of Vorna's troop. "Harlan!" she yelled. "Harlan!"
"He ain't here," Lucius Vorna said.
He stood in front of her, aiming a bolt pistol at her heart. Part of his face was eaten away to the bone by acid, and his carapace armor was covered in fresh, deep gouges.
"He ain't here, you witch. Toss the carbine."
She obeyed. Covering her, he raised his link. Kiss glanced up and saw a pair of predators on the platform rail above, rocking as they prepared to pounce on him.
"Siskind,"
Vorna yelled into his link.
"Teleport me, now!"
Lucius Vorna smiled at her, fired his pistol, and vanished. A cyclonic blur of pink light sucked him away. With a pop of decompression, the teleport cone removed Vorna, his weapon, and his smile. All it left behind as it faded was the bolt round ripping towards her. Kiss caught it. It took all of her telekinetic strength. She stopped the blistering round in midair, a meter from her body, and held it dead, at bay. She fought, her mind bending with the effort. The bolt round, stationary, began to deform and melt against the mind wall her kind force had thrown up. It thrust against her will, half a meter away, gouging through her telekinetic defense. She could see it clearly, spinning in space, metal sweating off it in slow, blobby droplets as it superheated. With a gasp, Kiss threw herself down. Released, the bolt round tore over her head and hit the wall behind her with an explosive crump. Kiss rose, the smoke making her choke. The two creatures perched on the rail bounced down onto the walkway ahead of her and began to advance. They yapped and chattered. She had no mind strength left anymore, nothing to keep them at bay. They leapt. They burst in splashes of ichor. Gun pods blazing, Ravenna's chair swept out of the doorway. It was horribly gouged and dented. Suspension fluid trickled out of deep-cut scars. Ravenna turned slowly, raking the walkway with sustained podfire. Skipping, jinking predators exploded and died.
"Patience!"
"Thrawn, you're alive!"
"Help me!"
He was in pain. He was hurt. Kiss scrambled up the steps onto the upper platform.
"The witch house is finished!" she yelled over the roar of the flames. "We have to leave!"
"Help me, Patience!"
Bleeding from an awful leg wound, Balak stumbled out of the doorway behind Ravenna. He was carrying Thonius, who was limp and lifeless.
"What happened?" Kiss yelled.
"No time to explain. Get them clear, Patience. That's all I ask."
Kiss ran to Balak and grabbed hold of him. His eyes were blank. He was being puppeted by Ravenna.
"I've got him,"
she cried. Ravenna let Balak go, and he slumped. Thonius looked dead. He was covered with blood. The house shuddered again and slipped. The deck pitched wildly.
"Gideon!"
Something detonated above them. The house rocked.
"Get them clear, Patience. Get them to the underboat while there's still a chance."
Kiss sucked in her breath and took hold of Balak and Thonius. She carried them, more with her tired mind than with her arms, down the steps onto the walkway, and then down again into the burning hell of the chamber's floor space.
"Please come with me," she sent back.
"I'll follow. Angharad is still through there. I'm wearing her. I can get her out."
Up on the top platform, Ravenna swung around to face the doorway.
"Come on, come on."
A black-and-white form pounced at his chair, He blew it apart with his cannons. Kiss reached the hoist and dropped Balak and Thonius onto its platform. She reached for the lever.
Gideon!
Go, Patience. I'll be right after you.
Kiss threw the lever. The hoist began to descend. Kiss heard a scuttering, scrabbling sound. She looked up. Five of the glossy black-and-white monsters were racing down the sheer walls of the riser shaft after her, limbs rippling as they tore down the soot-black sides of the drop. Shotgun raised, Lusik took another step up the spiral staircase. The house shook again, violently. That was bad, and he knew it. The house was reaching the end of its existence. Lusik aimed his shotgun up into the darkness of the stair shaft. He was sure he'd heard something above him, something descending. He couldn't see anything. He lowered his gun. Reaching into his back pocket, he took out his stab light and flicked it on. He shone the narrow beam up into the gloom. Nothing, except teeth. Something above him yapped. Hiram Lusik made a frantic grab for his shotgun. Kiss grabbed Balak's las pistol and fired it up at the monsters scurrying down the shaft after them. It snapped dead. It was spent. She reached frantically into his pockets for a fresh clip. The hoist was descending too slowly, far slower than the scurrying monsters. Carbine raised in one hand, lamp in the other. Pleiton stepped into the drum chamber. She could hear the hoist trundling down. A loud rattling crash came from the direction of the spiral staircase. She stepped closer to investigate. It was her shotgun. Her shotgun had just fallen down the spiral staircase onto the deck. The last time she'd seen, it had been in Lusik's possession. With slow, nauseating horror, Pleiton realized that an astonishingly copious amount of blood was streaming down out of the roof hatch. Swallowing hard, Pleiton cinched the carbine over her shoulder and picked up her shotgun. She backed away from the staircase towards the base plate of the hoist, keeping her shotgun steady. She tried to watch both, the staircase and the hoist, as soon as it appeared. The hoist dropped into view. Kiss was crouching at the center of the platform, with Balak and Thonius sprawled on either side of her.
"Maud! Maud! Shoot!"
Kiss screamed, pointing up the shaft. Pleiton leapt up onto the hoist platform between Kiss and the unconscious men. She fired upwards, blindly pumping shot after shot up into the dark. Kiss dragged Balak and Thonius off the hoist behind her. Kiss looked back. She had a prickling feeling that Pleiton had hit something. Kiss reached out and jerked Pleiton backwards off the hoist with her telekinesis, the instant before three ruptured, flopping bodies crashed down onto it out of the shaft. Pleiton got up, staring at the dead things.
"What the hell are those?" she asked in total revulsion.
"We've got to get back to the boat," Kiss barked, ignoring the question.
"Where's Ravenna?"
"He's coming."
Kiss hurried forward to throw the lever and send the hoist back up, but it was dead. Noxious bio-acid leaking from the burst throat sacs of one of the dead things had reduced the motor to metal goo.
"How is he coming?" asked Pleiton. "What about Nail and Sword Girl?"
"He'll use his psi," Kiss replied. "Gideon, the hoist is out of action." "Gideon?"
There was no answer. Kiss dragged Balak to his feet. He was coming around, groggy. She threw Thonius's limp body over her shoulder.
"Come on!"
She started off towards the service tunnel, dragging Balak after her, stumbling and confused. Pleiton fell in behind her, moving backwards, shotgun raised. Something black and white scuttled down the spiral staircase and smiled. She blasted it apart. The deck had twisted to a sharper angle, and the house was rattling with a constant shudder. Metal groaned and protested. In the docking pool, the water was boiling up through the wharf decking, a mass of froth and pressure. The underboat, still anchored by one sea chain, was bucking and thumping violently against the dockside fenders in the immense swell. Using telekinesis, Kiss shoved Thonius's body unceremoniously across and in through the side hatch. Then she jumped across with Balak. They nearly slipped off into the surging water, but she braced them with her mind, and they scrambled in through the hatch. The pilot servitor had already closed the top hatch. "We have to leave right now," he told Kiss.
"We're not all here,"
she replied, moving back to the side hatch.
"If the house goes," the servitor replied, "it'll take us with it. We won't have clearance to exit the dock pool. Cut the chain loose."
"We're not all here yet," Kiss yelled at him. "Get to the helm and get ready."
The pilot servitor scurried forward. She heard the fans start up and test rev. She got to the hatch and looked out. Plighton had remained on the dockside and was standing with her back to the pool, watching the approach from the service tunnel.
Maud?
No sign! Plighton yelled back over the roaring water and squealing metal.
Gideon!
Nothing. Plighton was suddenly shooting. The gritty boom of her shotgun rang out again and again. Over a dozen of the creatures were scurrying out of the service tunnel towards her. She killed two of them.
Maud!
There was a sudden, stomach-flipping lurch, and the house tilted even more sharply, throwing Plighton down. A curious, deep moaning sound began. It was coming from the pool. It was the sound of water stirring in vast quantities. The house had dipped so steeply, the air bell of the docking pool had lost its integrity, and oceanic water was surging up into the pool bay with shocking speed and fury. The docking pool was flooding.
Maud!
Plighton rose on the sharply inclined decking and leapt. She hit the side of the seesawing underboat, and Kiss dragged her in through the hatch. Scrambling, slipping, half-falling, the chattering things came after her. Kiss slammed the hatch shut and heard hooks clang and scrape against the outer hull.
"The sea chain!" the pilot servitor shouted at her. "What about the sea chain?"
The colossal power of the ocean answered him. The force of the flood lifted the underboat, slammed it against the metal dock, and then yanked it away. Black and white bodies tumbled away into the boiling water, the remaining sea chain caught, strained, and parted with an explosive crack. Released, the underboat rolled, righted, and fought the rising, crushing energy of the sea. The pilot blew air ballast and gunned his cavitation drive and attitude fans.
"What are you doing?"
Kiss screamed. "We have to get out," the pilot servitor yelled back. She lunged forward, but stopped herself. What could she do? Force him to stay? Kill him? Even if they stayed, what could they accomplish? The house was flooding, and was minutes, maybe seconds, from losing its foothold forever. Patience Kiss was a supremely capable, confident woman. She could do many things, against almost any odds. But she couldn't beat this. She was helpless. They were helpless. The ones they'd left behind, if they weren't dead already, were doomed.
"Gideon!"
she sent with such anguished force, Plighton and Balak winced. There was no answer. There would never be again. Chapter 4 Nail woke to find himself in hell. He was sprawled in the bottom floor space of the theatre chamber. The deck was at an almost 40-degree slope. His head pounded, and his throat hurt. He remembered Vorna grabbing him. He rose, swaying. The area around him was alive with leaping flames. His coat was on fire. He took it off and threw it aside. He made his way over to the hoist, but it was gone, and the black riser shaft stared up at him. There were bodies on the ground, two of Vorna's hired guns. They looked as if they had been snipped clumsily into pieces by giant scissors. He helped himself to the shotgun one of them had dropped. Something moved in the flames nearby. A dead-eyed horror with a rictus smile leapt out of the dancing fire to kill him. No hesitation. His newly acquired shotgun barked and punched it back where it had come from in a drizzle of purple fluid. Fighting the sloping deck, he reached the lower steps and got onto the walkway. There was no one around, no one alive anyway. He saw four more dead from Vorna's band, the corpses of two housekeepers rent limb from limb, and the crumpled forms of three more things like the one he had just wasted.
"What in Throne's name are these things?" he muttered.
Nail clambered around the walkway, leaping over a missing section of deck that looked as if it had been burnt away by acid. He made it to the upper steps. Serious-sounding explosions thumped somewhere outside the ruined chamber. The whole place was on fire. He crawled up onto the sloping upper platform. The roof dome above was a riotous inferno, and flames from below were searing up around the metal disc of the platform. The door frame was still standing, the door open and swinging, the red light of somewhere else shining through it. Ravenna's chair sat facing the door. It was scratched and battered, punctured in places. Clear fluid was dripping out of it.
"Ravenna!"
"Is that you, Harlan?" Nail staggered over to reach him.
"What the hell is going on?"
"I'm sorry," Ravenna replied, his vox-ponded voice frail and thready, as if the system were damaged, or as if he were damaged. "I'm very sorry. We're not getting out of here."
Where are the others?
Kiss has made her way out. She took Kao and Balak with her. I hope they made it to the underboat. I pray they did. I keep calling, but I'm very tired. My mind is weak. I can't reach Kiss.
What about Plankton?
Nail asked. Ravana sighed.
What about Ankh-Harad?
Nail said, more firmly. I'm still trying. She's there. I can feel her. But...
Gideon? For throne's sake, is she still in there?
I'm wearing her. She kept them at bay. She's still fighting them. I don't know how much longer she can last. She's an amazing woman, that Arianod.
You mean Ankh-Harad?
What?
You mean Ankh-Harad?
Yes, of course.
Another explosion rocked the chamber. Nail stepped towards the door.
Ankh-Harad!
He yelled into the red light.
Ankh-Harad!
Wait, Harlan, Ravana whispered. Wait. She's...
Something moved on the other side of the door. Backlit by the red glow, a figure limped into view. Ankh-Harad. She was covered in blood and smears of purple ichor. Her leather armor was torn and hanging off her in places. Her long steel smoked. She walked slowly out of the doorway onto the platform, leading the housekeeper guide behind her by the hand like a child.
Oh, throne!
Nail cried, running to them. The door slammed shut in its frame behind them. With a sob of pain and exhaustion, Ravana let Ankh-Harad go. She swayed, but she was conscious. Blood dripped from her mouth. Nail tried to hold her, but she pushed him off. She took two long steps towards Ravana's dented chair and rested the tip of Avisarex on its front cowling.
You bastard, she rasped. Without my permission. Without my permission. You were inside me. You were me.
I apologize, said Ravana.
You have violated my honor and the honor of my clan. You were inside me. I alone choose who gets to be inside me. That was mind rape. I should gut you for this offense, and...
I apologize, Ravana repeated. I did what I had to do. Balak and Thonius may be alive right now, because of what I did.
Ankh-Harad sank to her knees and let Avisarex slip to the deck. She shook with racking sobs. Nail crouched beside her and held her.
But as a consequence, we are doomed, said Ravana. I am so very sorry I have brought you to this end with me. The house is flooding and dying. There is no escape.
There's gotta be,
said Nail, looking up. He suddenly pushed Ankh-Harad away and leapt upright with his shotgun raised. A black-and-white shape, tail high, had just crept onto the upper platform behind Ravana. It stole forwards, claws scratching the deck plates. It raised its head, sniffing and yapping, its tongue stabbing out between its teeth.
Same to you, said Nail,
and killed it with a single shot. Its thrashing body flew backwards off the platform. Nail looked around at Ravana.
There's got to be a way out.
I can't find one, Ravana replied. I have been searching. I'm right, aren't I, housekeeper?
The housekeeper looked up sharply. Its cowled head had been bowed. It was toying with the key in its hands with grazed, bleeding fingers.
Yes,
the housekeeper replied.
We have no boats, no escape pods. When the house dies, we die too.
That's a load of...
Nail began.
Harlan, said Ravana calmly. His fatigue was so great he could barely summon the effort. When the house dies, it will let go of the ice above. It will fall, and when it falls, it will fall into the abyss. What was it Lusik called it? Holy water, Harlan, without a measurable bottom. In a minute or two, the water pressure will crush the house like an egg. Even at my best, I couldn't protect us. Certainly not long enough to get us back to the surface. Even then,
the ice. And, as you may have noticed, I'm not at my best. The Plighton woman was right, said Angharad softly. This place will kill us more surely than the void itself.
No, murmured Nail. Screw this. No, we don't just give up and wait to die.
Sometimes that's a warrior's fate, said Angharad. She picked up her steel and wiped the blade before sheathing it. The blade was stained and bruised with acid.
Balls to that, Nail snapped. That's fancy warrior talk. I'm a paid gun. We think percentages. I don't worship any frigging honor code. Lou was right about that. About me. I worship chances, edges, survival. We have a way out.
No, Harlan, Ravenna sighed. We're done. Nail glared at Ravenna.
We have a friggin' way out, he insisted. We still have one way out left to us.
He nodded towards the door.
Absolutely not, said Angharad with a shudder. You haven't seen what's through there.
You have.
That's why I won't go. It's death.
You survived it, lady.
Barely.
We can survive it together.
It's death, Harlan Nail, she said flatly.
So is this, he said.
I'd rather die fighting for a chance than roll over and wait for death to get me.
The witch house shuddered again and tilted more steeply. They had to hold on. Nail looked down. Through the mesh of the platform, he could see black water pouring up through the riser shaft to flood the floor space below them. Fires, caught by the swirling water, guttered and went out.
Last call, he said. Who's with me?
Angharad raised her head and wiped the blood from her mouth. She drew her sword.
I am, I suppose, she said.
There was a long pause, broken only by the death-throw explosions of the house.
So am I, said Ravenna.
He turned his chair to face the housekeeper.
Come with us, he said.
The housekeeper nodded.
We need your key.
The housekeeper nodded again.
What's your name? Ravenna asked.
The housekeeper slowly lowered the hood of its gown. It was a she, a young girl barely into adolescence. Her face was thin, pale, and fringed by cropped blonde hair.
I am Ayasub, she said.
I'm glad to know you, Ayasub, Ravenna said. Open the door for us.
The girl raised her ancient key and fitted it into the lock. It turned, and the door opened. Nail and Angharad stood beside her, weapons raised and ready. The door opened. Gunshot red sunlight glowed out. They all recoiled at the alien smell.
Let's go, if we're going, said Harlan Nail,
racking the slide of his shotgun. They stepped through the door, and it slammed shut behind them. A second later, the witch house died. They were being shaken around like beads in a drum. Thunderous water had entirely flooded the docking pool, but the upthrust of current was such that the underboat couldn't right itself or dive. Twice, the boat slammed into the dock roof. Water seethed around them, aspirated, shimmering with bubbles. Kiss, Plighton, and Balak had all been cut or bruised by impact sustained from the underboat's violent capture. Thonius, dead as far as Kiss was concerned, had fallen off his bench seat. He rolled, leaden, across the trunk flooring. Only the pilot servitor, strapped into his chair, was intact.
Get us out, Kiss yelled at him, holding on tight. You wanted to get us out, so get us out.
I can't, the servitor wailed back, fighting with the helm controls. The pressure wave coming in is too great. It's forcing us up into the dock roof. The underboat heaved and slammed again. Warning lights lit up. Plighton was thrown the length of the trunk. Balak, clinging grimly to handholds, blood pouring down his leg, stared at Kiss.
Blow all the ballast, he suggested.
Would that work?
Kiss asked the pilot frantically.
Do I ask you how to do your job? The pilot snapped back. No, it wouldn't work.
Ask him why,
Balak yelled.
Why? Kiss relayed. Because I've already blown the ballast, the pilot replied. What am I, an amateur? I'm hardwired to drive underboats, and I'm telling you, miss, that we're...
An upswell of water hit them and punched them into the dock roof so hard the hull buckled. Klaxons sang out, but they were all too busy falling and rolling. Kiss landed on Balak, who screamed in pain.
"Oh, good throne," the pilot began.
He had seen how fast and violently the needle of the depth meter was spinning.
"What?"
Kiss demanded. "We are dropping." With one last aching shudder, the witch house lost its grip on the ceiling of ice. It fell away in a huge expanding cloud of ice particles and streaming, exhaling air. Legs flailing, it sank like a stone into the dark expanse of holy water yawning below. The darkness embraced it. Its superstructure began to crimp and crush with the pressure. Fluttering, winking trails of silver bubbles streamed up from its vents like contrails. The falling house rotated, rolled, and inverted. Upside down, the docking pool flushed out violently. The stricken underboat flew up out of the entry hatch like a cork.
"Steady it! Steady it!" Kiss yelled, holding tight to the seat back.
"I'm trying," the pilot servitor cried. His augmented hands pulled at the steering controls. The ventral fans spun, floundering, drowning in the under-rip of the falling house. The pilot hit the cavitation drive. The underboat struggled, dragged down, then turned its nose upwards. They shot up, like a released boy, hull plates groaning and bending.
"Where's the house?" Plighton asked, struggling into the pilot house.
Kiss shook her head. Far below, in the blackness, they glimpsed a falling structure that swiftly dropped out of sight into the abyss.
"Auspex?"
Kiss asked the pilot servitor. He hit several switches. The scanner system painted the descending house as a small yellow blip.
"Great throne," Balak whispered.
He had climbed in beside them, staring at the console. The blip dropped away into the lower depths. It fizzled once, twice, and then vanished forever.
"Crushed by the pressure," the pilot servitor said. "It's gone."
Kiss sat back and began to cry. No one said anything for a very long time. Chapter 5
"Tell me again slowly," said Kara Swole. "What happened when you went through this door?"
"We were in the hellish red place at first," Balak said. "It just had a feeling to it, a terrible feeling of menace. Then the housekeeper opened the door again, and we went through to a place that was near Dorsey, on Gudrun. But it wasn't now, it was the future, many years in the future."
"This portal took you to different places and times?" Kara asked cautiously, like a Skolam tutor examining a pupil's elaborate excuse for inconsistencies.
"Yes," said Balak. "It was a distressing and disorientating experience. The door was in control all the time. It made us wait while it opened, as if it was choosing what to show us next. That is how I understood it to work. You asked it a question, and it took you to places from which some answer or answers might be discerned. What those answers are, I believe, is very much a matter of interpretation."
"And then?"
"And then it took us to another place. A rural field. I don't know the time or the place. A man was waiting there for us. Ravana went down and spoke with him. Then he returned and told us we were going back."
"Who was the man?" asked Kara.
"It was the facilitator, Orfeo Kalzian," said Balak.
"How do you know?" asked Kara.
"Ravana told us."
"I don't remember him saying anything of the sort," said Carl Thonius.
They looked around at him. Carl was sitting in the window seat of the Berenth apartment's main room, huddled in blankets. His haggard face was especially thin and pale, and discolored by bruises and dozens of linear scabs. His voice was an unhealthy whisper.
"My dear Carl," said Balak gently, "you were quite agitated at the time. I doubt you remember much of anything."
Thonius shrugged and looked away, out through the window. Once they'd got clear of the house, and there had been time to attend to him, Kiss and Plighton had found Carl to be only superficially hurt, his face and body battered and scratched. His death-like state, from which he had gradually recovered, had been put down to severe shock.
"Kalzian," said Kara, rising to her feet, "so he and Molotch were 3 steps ahead of us the whole while. It was all a trap, in other words, Dantu Vona being on hand to close the house down once you were in."
"It worked well, didn't it?" said Kiss, bitterly.
Kara took a deep breath. She had come down to the surface the moment Kiss had restored contact. She could still not believe the news they had broken to her. Ravana and Nail, dead,
Angharad, too. Dead and gone. Everyone was numb. Grief would follow, later. She looked around the room. Karl, the most physically hurt of them all, huddled in the window seat. Balak by the fire, his ugly leg wound, bound and strapped. A walking cane to hand. Maud Plagton in the corner, lost in her own thoughts, staring at the floor. Kiss, standing by the door, head bowed, suffering the most intensely. Kara stepped towards her and, not for the first time since their reunion, embraced her. They held on to each other for a moment. The two of them had lost the most. Gideon Ravener and Harlan Nail had been their true friends and comrades for a long time. Kara fought the urge to cry. She could feel the heat of sorrow rising. She held it back. They all seemed to be looking to her now, the heart of the shattered group, or at least what remained of it. Kiss was too wrapped up in anguish and self-loathing to be a leader. More than once, as she had haltingly told Kara of Ravener's death, she had said, "I should have stayed with him. I left him behind." Kara let Kiss go and made her sit. She looked back at Balak. "The rest now. Let me hear it. I want to hear it."
"We went back through the door. It took us to a hive somewhere, as if it was playing with us, refusing Ravener's request to take us home. Then, back to the Red Hell again. Once it had us there, it refused to open any more. That was Moloch's trap for us. I believe he may have commanded the door somehow to take us to that place and maroon us there, where those things could find us and kill us. I would not put such a feat past Zygmunt Moloch."
"Nor I," said Karl.
"Except..."
"Except Karl?" Kara asked.
"Why so elaborate? I know Moloch has a penchant for the baroque and theatrical, but why all that? Why take us to Kalzean? Why arrange a meeting where they conversed for some minutes? Why not just kill us?"
"He wanted something from us," said Kiss, looking up. "He wanted something from Ravener. A deal, I think. Vorna could have just killed us, but he was waiting for something. Waiting for orders to kill us or spare us."
"That's right," said Plighton,
speaking for the first time in hours. "Lusik and the gunman holding me had a conversation to that effect. They were waiting for word to come. They were holding us until they knew if we could be friends or not."
"Friends?" Kara echoed.
"I heard them say it," said Plighton. "That very word. The bounty hunter seemed to doubt it. I think he was pretty certain they'd just end up executing us. But from what's been said, I think it depended on Ravener's answer to whatever this Kalzean was offering."
Kiss shook her head. "What in the name of terror could Moloch and Kalzean have been proffering that could have made us friends? I mean, what? What were they thinking? Ravener would never side with Moloch, for any reason."
"Well, he clearly said no," said Thonius.
"But there must have been a chance he'd say yes," said Kara, "or they wouldn't have gone to all that effort."
"Whatever, he said no,"
Thonius snapped, "which is why we were sent back into Moloch's trap. That was his insurance, to wipe us out if Ravener refused him."
"That's when the door wouldn't open?" Kara asked Balak.
The interrogator smoothed back his long white hair and nodded.
"And then the creatures came for us. I don't know what they were. I have never even heard of their like. They were
awful,"
said Thonius quietly.
"Beautiful."
"That's a strange choice of words," said Kiss. "I saw them too, remember?"
"So did I," shuddered Plighton. "They weren't beautiful. They..."
"Anything that is so immaculately designed to do what it does is beautiful,"
Thonius cut in.
"They were the most terrifying things I have ever seen. But they were perfect, too. Perfect killing machines. So driven and single-minded and pure."
"Pure evil,"
said Balak.
"Not even that," said Thonius. "Just pure. Just themselves. Hungry and alien. Implacable. Utterly lacking in any emotional or intellectual quality we might recognize except ruthless, relentless hunger. I'd rather have tried to reason with an orc or a scion of the arch-enemy. At least they have
needs and urges and ambitions, diction and intellect. At least there could be, however unlikely, a basis for dialogue. But those things, Moloch chose his assassins well.
So the door was locked, Kara said to Balak. These things were upon you.
I have to ask, how did you get out?
Kiss rose and walked into the adjacent room to pour herself a drink from the stand. Her nerves were shot, but, more particularly, she didn't want any of the others to see how incapable she was of controlling her tears. They streamed down her cheeks. Her body ached, and her hands shook as she selected a clean glass and filled it with Amasek.
Gideon, I'm so sorry. I should not have left you.
Through the open door behind her, she heard Balak's voice.
We were overrun. It was a nightmare. We were seconds away from being torn to ribbons. Ravana was wearing me and Angharad. It was relentless, just a blur of instinct and frenzy. Then Karl fell to them. I thought he was dead for sure. I thought I was next.
Kiss sipped her drink, listening. Balak's voice had dropped low and had become strained with emotion.
There was a sudden flash. Red light. Red energy. I remembered thinking it was all red. But everything was already red in that place. This was intense and sudden, like a bomb going off. The energy flared like...
Like what? Kiss heard Kara ask.
Like pain. Like rage. It tasted of rage and fury. I swear it was a psychic event.
Ravana.
No,
Balak whispered.
I don't think so. It didn't come from him. It was just there, a demonic spasm from the depths of the immaterium. It lashed out and burned the creatures off us. It threw them back, melted and twisted and broken. It saved us. It blew the door open, against the door's will.
Then what?
I don't remember. Just scraps, really. I remember staggering back through the door, still under Ravana's control. I'd found Karl on the ground, surrounded by the slaughtered ruins of a dozen creatures. Ravana willed me to pick him up, and of course I did.
Kiss walked back into the doorway.
It was psychic, she said.
Kara looked around at her.
I was in the theater chamber when the door blew. Balak is absolutely right. It was a psychic event. I felt it. I smelled it. It was raw and uncontrolled. It was feral. I assumed it was Ravana's doing. I assumed it was his desperation.
Kara nodded, adding as she did so, And then?
Ravana was wounded. Dreadfully wounded, Kiss said.
Balak was out of it, conquered by pain.
Karl was unconscious, too. Ravana told me to get them clear, to get them back to the underboat. He told me he would follow as soon as he had Angharad. And like a fool, I obeyed him. I took them, and I made my escape, and I left Gideon there to die.
She looked down at the drink in her hand and set it down.
Excuse me, she said,
and walked towards the apartment's exit.
Patience,
Kara called after her.
Not now, Ka,
Kiss replied, and slammed the hatch behind her. There was a long silence. The fire guttered in the grate.
Kiss will move past this in time,
Balak said.
She will accommodate this, and...
Shut up, you ninka,
Kara snapped.
You don't know the first thing about what we...
Kara,
said Karl quietly. Kara breathed in and out, hard.
Forgive me, Balak. This is a difficult time for us, and I shouldn't have said that to you. I know you were only trying to help.
It's all right,
said Balak.
I'm aware I'm an outsider here, new to this company. I should remember that.
What happens now? Asked Plighton. I mean, apart from the fact that it's over and everything.
There may be some traces left here on Utokri, Moloch, or Vorna,
said Balak.
Some leads, some signs of their handiwork. They went to a lot of trouble setting this up.
And if we find them? Kara asked.
Moloch is still out there,
said Balak.
Our mission is still not completed. If we can find a single lead, I say we use it. In Ravana's name, we use it. We track Moloch to ground, and make him pay for what he has done.
Closure? Asked Kara.
Closure,
Balak agreed.
It's all we have left, and it's what Ravana would have wanted.
Kara nodded. Plighton shrugged, tears in her eyes, then nodded too.
It's not at all what he'd have wanted,
said Thonius, rising to his feet and dropping his blankets.
What?
Come on,
said Thonius, looking at Kara. This is stupid. This is becoming mindless. We've torn ourselves apart hunting for this heretic, and still he eludes us. Maybe it's time we recognize that he's always going to beat us.
No.
Well, Kara Swole, I say yes, said Thonius. And, funnily enough, I think I'm in charge here now. I am Ravenna's interrogator. That gives me acting command in his absence. There is only one course of action left open to us now.
And what might that be?
Asked Kara. Thonius shrugged.
We should go directly to Thracian Primaris and present ourselves to the High Conclave of the Ordos Helicon. We should make full account of our misadventure, in all detail, and throw ourselves upon the mercy of Lord Rorkon.
No, said Kara.
Again, yes, Kara,
Thonius said, clearly and precisely.
We broke all the rules, and we still failed. I doubt very much I've got a career left, but I know what's right. Ravana should have done this months ago. It behooves us to make amends and start repairing the damage we have done, even if it means we offer ourselves up to the most stringent discipline of the Inquisition.
He limped across the room, picked up Kiss's abandoned drink, and knocked it back.
Let's pack up and make our way as penitents. Let's try to make good the wrong we have wrought. It's too late to even think otherwise.
Gideon, I'm so sorry. I should not have left you.
Two floors down from the apartment, Kiss sat alone in the dim stairwell of the ancient building and wept. Two floors down was as far as she'd got after storming out. She'd been intending to find a saloon or a bar to purchase a drink and maybe get into a pointless argument or a fight. But her legs had failed, and she sat down on the worn wooden steps. Ravana was gone. Ravana was dead. Harlan was dead. Nothing would ever be the same again. Ever. She heard footsteps coming up the stairwell below her. A resident of the block, perhaps. She ignored the approach, hoping whoever it was would step by her and leave her be, perhaps mistaking her for some stack wretch who'd come into the building to attempt begging. The footsteps came closer. Someone sat down on the stairs beside her.
I am abjectly aloof for any words to make fulsome expression,
said Sholto Unworth. Kiss laughed, despite herself.
Where did you come from? I was, foremost, checking of the lander, so that with all convenientness it might be ready to take us aloft.
Is it ready?
It is, Patience.
He reached into his pocket and offered her a handkerchief.
Avoid that part,
he said, indicating,
for I may have subsequently blown on it. The rest is quite fresh.
Don't look at me, she said, her eyes streaming. I have snot coming out of my nose.
It is quite dark,
he said, looking around.
I can define little of your mucus, so modestly is assured.
She laughed again.
Is it true?
He asked. She nodded and blew her nose.
Well, I am 5 saken,
he said. 5?
It is 1 more than 4 saken,
he replied.
It is a level of grief behind which there is no furthest most.
Except 6.
Pray no one ever experiences 6 saken,
Unworth said. She could see he had small tears in his eyes.
I am preempt,
he said quietly.
I am stricken. I am beside yourself.
I'm glad of that, she said.
He was a good man, as floating chairs go,
said Unworth.
He was. I think he likened of me to the end, and made his trust upon me, in some measuring. I hope so.
I believe he did, Sholto. Gideon would not have kept your company if he didn't trust you.
Well, I had a ship, and I was excrescently pliantable,
Unworth countered. There is that. Unworth frowned thoughtfully.
Are you all right?
he asked.
I will be.
Unbidden, he curled his short arms up around her shoulders and pulled her tight.
You will indeed be, he said. Sholto,
Kiss said, sniffing, comforted by his little embrace.
He was there. I saw him. Who?
She nodded.
The man who hurt you. Lucius Vorna. He nearly killed me. I nearly killed him. I wish I had, for your sake. I would have done it, but he had the drop on me and teleported away. He...
She paused.
What?
Unworth asked.
He teleported away,
Kiss whispered, with growing realization.
He called to Siskind and teleported away.
She broke the embrace.
Siskind! Siskind! It's got to be the same Siskind, hasn't it? The allure's here! Throne! Why didn't I connect this before? The allure's here!
She got up and turned back up the stairs.
Can you scan for it?
She asked as she ran.
It will be of significated disguise,
he said, scrambling after her.
But I know its particulates, its draft and measure, its signature. The Arethusa can match its pattern. Come on! Can't you run any faster? There is a bigness to these stairs that I am not as copious with as your long leggage.
Do you want me to carry you? She snapped. He stopped. She stopped, too, and looked back at him.
That would be just undignified, wouldn't it?
She said.
Incandescently,
he replied. Chapter 6
Red heat. Again, the gun shot sun. The area around the lonely door is heaped with the mangled corpses of the black-and-white organisms. I feel some pride that we managed to slay so many. Most of this was Angharad's work. There is no sign of life, but there is still the sense of dread, the shadow in the warp. I am trusting that the door will allow us to step away from this place. We cannot stay here long. Angharad feels it. She watches the horizon, Eviscerex angled in her grip. She is exhausted. She will not withstand another clash like the one we have just been through. Nail feels it too, coming new to this experience of stepping into another time-place. He raises his weapon, tense suddenly. He was right. This is the only option. Staying in the house to die along with it would have been the decision of one foolish and weak. I am weary, and I am wounded, but I am not foolish, and I am not weak. Not yet. Soon, perhaps. The damage I have sustained to my support systems, the leakage of fluid, may be critical. I believe I am already dying. Worse, my mind is frail and utterly incapable of defending us. Every movement is an effort to me.
What happens now?
Nail asks me, nervously. We wait, I tell him, trying to hide from him how useless I am.
For how long?
For however long it takes.
They're coming, says Angharad. The Carthaean steel bristling in her fists.
Eviscerex thirsts.
I'm sure it does, I reply. I look at Iosob, the child, the housekeeper. She is afraid. Things have never gone this way for her before. Iosob? She fumbles with the key.
We wait.
And then?
Then the key may turn, but the door locked us here before. Your enemy, what was his name?
Moloch.
Moloch. He made adjustments to the door. He prepared it. It may not open again. He was very knowledgeable.
I look out at the black headland of volcanic rock Angharad is watching.
What else do you know about him? I ask.
Nothing,
Iosob says.
He came. He contained us. He killed some of the housekeepers to make his point. He was very skilled in his work.
I have some skills of my own, I say.
But you no longer have the demon.
What?
The demon. The demon that saved us when the hooked things came the first time. It drove them back and threw the door wide open. I assumed it was your demon.
You are mistaken. I don't own a demon, I reply. What are you talking about?
The house knows,
she says.
You brought a demon in here with you last time. A howling fury of the warp. It is the only reason you survived.
What the hell is she talking about?
Nail asks. Iosob, what do you mean? I feel she is terribly confused, her memory of the traumatic incident patchy. Perhaps she mistook my mental powers for something darker. Ayasob looks away at the black outcrop, scared.
They're coming again, Gideon, who is Ravana.
Last time, you called them the Great Devourer, Ayasob. I heard you. What are they?
They are the future. Passing through the three-way door, we have seen them several times. 300 years from our now, they will become Behemoth.
What is Behemoth?
Behemoth, Kraken, Leviathan.
Ayasob? She whimpers and drops the key. She bends down and searches for it in the dust.
The Imperium will shake. They will be the worst enemies mankind has ever faced.
What are they called? I ask.
They don't have a name yet,
she replies.
Not yet.
She finds the key and rises again. This is the future, then, I ask.
This is what the door shows. 300-400 years gone by from our now. This is what we have seen, sometimes.
She glances around.
Oh, they're coming back.
The child is right, grunts Angharad. I've got 18 shells in this pump shot, says Nail. What happens when they're spent?
Try the door, please, Ayasob, I instruct. I look back at Nail. I have a feeling, Harlan, that just after you expend your 17th round, you're going to wish you had stayed aboard the Witch House and died.
Charming, he replies. I can always count on you for a positive spin.
Ayasob tries the key in the lock. It refuses to turn.
The door is not ready,
she tells me.
Oh, well, it may not ever be ready.
Keep trying the key, please. I wait. Nail strides around me.
Gideon, he asks, if the witch house dies, how long will this damn door last?
I don't know. If it was anchored to the house, not long. I'm hoping, praying, it exists beyond the house's dimensions.
Well, that's a relief, he mocks.
Ravana! Angharad is alert suddenly. I turn and see what she has seen, a dust cloud rising above the black volcanic outcrop. It drifts slowly, a yellow, oblong smudge. More of them! Please, Ayasob, try the key again. This time, miraculously, it turns. The door opens. The door opens 3 times, in fact. To an empty, wind-blown step. To a hazed plain of Duricrust under a night sky where what can only be the eye of terror swirls and crackles like a diseased sun. And then to a forest of white, glassy trees beside a green-black lake. There is no immediate threat here, no sense of doom, no trace of life, apart from the curious trees and small, pale wasps. We rest there, just for an hour or two. We have to keep going, for I cannot tell how long we will have use of the door, or how many times we will have to walk through it before we find a time and place remotely connected to our origin. But we can only go on if we rest first. We have no food, and cannot trust the lake's water. I test it with my systems, and find it is unpotable. It isn't even water. Angharad lies down and sleeps. So does the housekeeper, her small head resting against the trunk of a glassy tree. Nail paces up and down. It is cold. Up through the white branches of the trees, the sky is a silky grey, and sprinkled with star systems, I don't know. How far away are we, I wonder? How many parsecs? How many years? Is this even our galaxy? I try to rest my mind, and soothe it with Psychana rituals, probing it for damage, cleansing it of fatigue. Meditation may restore some of my strength. But I am aware of my body. I am aware of physicality, my shrunken form, cold and helpless and dense inside the chair. These are sensations the chair usually spares me. I consider again what Ayasob said. What demon did she think she saw? If there is any truth to her words, I have one suspicion, one I cannot do anything about. In extremis, when I had to wear him, there was something artificial in Balak's head that previous scans had not shown to me.
To wear someone, though, gives a different, deeper insight. At the time, I had been far too busy, far too frantic to pay it much heed, but now, in quiet reflection, I remember it. It was a block, a baffle, artificially imposed, almost undetectable, a very sophisticated piece of psychic architecture. It was designed to keep a part of Balak's mind invisible to me. I have seen the type of thing before in my life, most particularly in a technique honed by the Cognitae, which they called the Black Dam. What was he hiding behind it? What was his connection to the Noetic School? Did he install the dam himself, or was it placed there without his knowledge by someone else? Was it Balak who left a footprint on Maud Plighton's psyche? Had Balak been hiding a demon in his mind all along?
Gideon.
Nail took a step closer to the silent chair. The surface of it was scratched and battered, with a patina that looked as if it had been sandblasted. Congealed fluid clogged some of the deeper gouges.
Gideon.
Harlan.
Ravenous Voxponder wheezed and replied.
Were you asleep?
I think so. I think I must have been.
Sorry. It's hard to tell.
Nail looked around. Angharad was curled up and slumbering like a cat. The housekeeper looked like a lost child, huddled in a storybook woodland.
It's been about 3 hours. Actually, that's a guess, because my cron is acting really funny. But my gut says 3 hours.
He glanced at the sky.
And it's getting darker and colder.
We should use the door again, said Ravenna.
Do you think it really will take us home?
He asked. I doubt we'll get anything as precise as that, said Ravenna. I'm hoping for a recognizable Imperial location, even a remote one, or a ship, within 5 years either way of our exit point.
5 years?
Nail asked, doubtfully.
As much as that?
If we get as close as that, I'll be content, Ravenna replied. I'm rather afraid the door's operating system is impaired. It's no longer opening in response to a question of coherence. I think we're traveling at random. I'm not even sure that the locations it's opening for us are going to be compatible with human forms. Nail raised his eyebrows.
That's a nice thought I hadn't yet considered. So the next time we open the door, it could lead to... what? An airless world? A toxic atmosphere?
The open void. The warp. The heart of a star. Or, back to the witch house. This escape route comes with no guarantee it is an escape route at all. We may have simply postponed our fate. In the light of that, I'm sure you'll agree, 5 years and a few light years out would be something of a miracle. Nail nodded thoughtfully.
You never did tell me if you got an answer, he said.
I got part of one. The door took me to Moloch, or to the world where he was hiding, at least.
Where was that?
There was no way to tell. Orfeo Kalzean was waiting for me there.
To kill you?
To talk to me.
You're joking,
Nail laughed. He had a proposition. He wanted to make a pact with me. It seems he and Moloch are deeply concerned about Slight. Nail rubbed the bruises Vorna's hand had left on his throat.
Slight.
Kalzean was suggesting that Moloch and I worked together to combat Slight. He wanted us to put an end to our fight and work in unison against a mutual enemy. I said no. Ravenna fell silent. He had no intention of telling Nail the details of the conversation.
If you'd said yes,
Nail asked. Kalzean would have sent us back through the door, and Vorna would have conveyed us off Utokri to wherever Moloch was waiting. Because I said no, he used the door as a murder weapon.
I thought the Slight business was over. I thought we'd gone past the critical point. What does Moloch know that we don't?
Perhaps nothing. We may know more about it than him. He may not be aware that the critical point, as you put it, has passed.
I doubt that,
said Nail.
Since when has he ever known less than us?
Wake the others, Ravenna said.
The next turn of the key brought them out onto a ragged plateau of ancient, crumbling granite. Extreme age had caused the rock to rot and lose its constitution. Beyond the plateau, a ragged world stretched away under a sky threaded by blinking whiskers of lightning. The next opened the door to a fog-bound marsh. It was humid, and the air was bad. So was the standing water. Thread-thin worms writhed in the mire, pulsing their wretched mouths and firing millivolt electrical impulses that prickled at the traveller's legs as they waded around. The door opened and closed behind them again. A vast rift valley of yellow rock gouged out under a Celpic blue sky spread out in front of them. The valley was 10 kilometers wide and 4 or 5 deep. It was achingly hot, and the heat was dry. The air smelled like metal. "Leave this place quickly," Ravenna said. His chair systems were reading a blaze of solar radiation. Next, a small coral atoll in the middle of a choppy ocean, washed violet by small, wobbling jellyfish in vast profusion. There was no other land in sight. The sky was a pink haze. A booming sound kept echoing out across the distance. Very far away, indistinct in the haze, some great, basking shape rose from the sea and rolled slowly back in.
"Next," said Nail.
Next was a dark, black forest, bitter and damp. The air hinted at advanced decay, and the merest pricks of white sky penetrated the thick, black fronds of the trees. They moved a little way from the door, hoping to see signs of habitation or perhaps a trail. Odd sounds knocked and chirruped in the darkness. Tiny black flies began to buzz around them. Angharad brushed them away from her face. They were very small, like fleas. In a few seconds, the clouds of them had become unbearably thick, blackening exposed skin and swirling into nostrils, ears, and eyes. "Exit," Ravenna ordered. Ayasob struggled with the key, moaning through tightly pursed lips as she tried to shake off the flies. Ravenna summoned a little of what was left of his will and let it wash out, sweeping the flies away for a second. The door opened. Here, a boneyard, a windy, cold desert of blue-gray dust. The chasing wind fanned horsetails of loose dust off the tops of dunes. The vast, dry bones of long-dead animals covered the landscape as far as they could see, tumbled in disarticulated heaps, half-submerged in the dust. These animals had been giants. The sky was a mottled brown, and the lasfire streaks of shooting stars, all descending at the same 45-degree angle, flickered across it like sparks off a grinding wheel. Ravenna's three companions crunched out amongst the bone waste, spitting phlegm black with dead flies out of their mouths. "Open the door again," said Angharad, humorlessly. Ayasob obeyed, and they came into a city. It was a frigid, bare place of cyclopean blocks under a yellow sky, dominated by a ringed gas giant. There was little doubt at all that the city was not of human construction.
"Have you seen anything like this before?" Nail asked.
Sound had a strange, hollow echo to it. The cold air held a sweet tang, like sugar.
"No," said Ravenna.
They wandered the area around the door for 5 minutes. "It's been dead a long time, hasn't it?" asked Angharad.
"No," said Ravenna. "I can feel something here. A presence."
Nail raised his gun.
"It's far away," said Ravenna. "But I can feel it. It's not human."
He turned his chair.
"Open the door again, please, Ayasob. I don't think we're safe here."
As they went through the door, Nail wondered quite what Ravenna had felt to make him so sure of that. The next place was an arid plain, cracked and shrunken like sun-damaged skin. Weird, succulent plant growth, like sprouts of brain tissue, formed forests on either side of the parched plain. A few kilometers away, the rusted, buckled shell of some colossal machine lay derelict on the ground. It looked like part of a starship, but what kind they couldn't tell. There was no time to debate or investigate. The atmosphere was barely breathable. Nausea enveloped them, and they started to gasp and choke. It seemed to take forever for the key to turn.
"Throne!"
Nail exclaimed as they made their next exit.
"Be careful! Watch your step!"
The door had opened onto a narrow platform of rough-hewn, untreated wood. It was part of a massive and not altogether reliable-looking matrix of scaffolding erected around a huge, decaying, ooze-like tower. They were close to the top, in bright midday sunlight and fresh wind, and the platform was 1,000 meters above the hazy sprawl of a huge city. Hundreds of dirty smoke trails rose from the city roofscape. The platform swayed as they moved gingerly out across it. Ayasob held onto a scaffold crossmember and refused to look down. She shut her eyes.
"I don't like this," she said.
"Do we climb down?" asked Anharad, blithely standing on the edge and staring down, her hands on her hips. "There is life here. I can hear it. Bustle. There is movement in the streets. Teeming life. It looks like an imperial city." "I think we would regret doing that," said Ravana. "It's teeming with life, all right. But I'm not reading human minds anywhere. I think this was an imperial city once."
"So who's down there now?" asked Nail. "And might they not at least have things like water and food?"
The towers and buildings nearest to them, none as tall as their vantage place, were also in bad repair and strung with complex networks of primitive scaffolding. It was hard to tell if the city was being repaired or dismantled by its new owners. Angharad's keen eyes picked out figures moving on the scaffolding on a neighboring tower 400 meters below them. Laborers at work. "Ravana is right. There's no point climbing down."
"What can you see?" Nail asked.
"Orcs," she replied, mildly. When the door opened next, it was into a black space. There was no light whatsoever, just cold, musty air.
"Gideon,"
Nail called out. Ravana ignited his chair's lamp systems. His power was alarmingly low, because the lamps did not blaze with their usual white intensity. The yellow glow revealed their surroundings. A stone chamber, rectangular, about the size of the Arethusa's secondary hold. Walls, floor, and ceiling were made of the same flush-fitting stone blocks, expertly built and, though there were no signs of wear or decay or even dust, very old.
"There's no door," said Angharad.
You noticed that," said Nail.
"I mean, no other door," she said, "unless it is concealed."
"It isn't," Ravana said. "I have scanned. The chamber is sealed and solid."
"Why would someone build it, then? For what purpose, if you can't get in and out of it?"
"Maybe they can," said Ravana. "Maybe they have a teleport. Maybe they don't want to come in here. Maybe it's sealed to keep something in."
"But there's nothing in here except us," said Nail.
He looked at Ravana sharply.
"Is there?"
"I don't think so."
"Door!" Angharad declared.
"We could at least rest here for a few minutes," said Ravana. "It has the merit of being free from the sort of health hazards we've found elsewhere." They sat down beside his chair and stared at the door.
"Ayasob," said Ravana after a while,
"I've been thinking about the door. It's operating randomly, isn't it?" She shrugged.
"I do not know. That is not my function. But I think that's very likely."
"Without the house to anchor it, the door is cut loose, directionless." She shrugged again.
"That is not
your function, I know. How old are you, Ayasob?"
14 years.
"You were raised in the house."
"I was raised by the family of housekeepers to be a housekeeper, as my mother's before me."
"And you're not psychically active in any way?"
"I don't believe I am. How would I know?"
Ravana was already pretty certain. He had gently scanned her several times and found no trace. Her mind, indeed, seemed a strangely lonely, unhappy place, empty of the usual buzz of thoughts.
"None of the housekeepers were psychers, were they?" he asked. She shook her head.
"Is that important?"
Nail asked.
"However the door operates," Ravana said, "it involves a strong psychic process. I don't know if the house was doing that, or someone we never met. The housekeepers are not active, because active psychers would have interfered with the door's operation. In fact, I think they were brought up under very particular circumstances, extensive ritual conditioning to keep their minds very calm." He had been going to say vacant, but didn't want to in front of Ayasob.
"With the house gone," Ravana said, "I was wondering if I could start to influence it. I was wondering if my mind could engage with it enough to guide us." They got back on their feet. Ravana reached out and probed the door the way he would a living mind. He felt foolish doing it, for although the door had an undeniable background vibration of power, it was just a wooden door. "Our most immediate concern is thirst," said Ravana. "Open the door." Chapter 7 They stepped through into a blustery, fresh, cold wind. They were in a rocky foreshore, a strand of limestone with a crashing grey sea on one side and a range of low cliffs on the other. A low sky full of murky clouds was racing past at what seemed an abnormally fast rate. There was moisture in the wind, and the bluster was raising eddies of chasing spray off the wet rock.
"You found water," said Nail. He nodded towards the breaking sea, 50 meters away. "But unless that's fresh water."
"It isn't," said Angharad. "You can taste the brine in the air." She paused. "Step towards me slowly, Nail."
"What?" "Do as she says."
10 meters behind Nail, what they had taken to be a slab of wet rock had stirred. It was an immense, pallid crocodilian creature with a long, slender snout. It had been basking on the foreshore in the ocean spray. It raised its broad body on 4 large flipper limbs and slithered lazily down towards the water. They looked around and saw there were a great number of the things, camouflaged into the grey limestone, basking in colonies all along the chilly shore. Some lay with their mouths wide open. They seemed languid and not the least interested in the visitors.
"Think there's more than 18 of them?"
Nail asked.
"Why?"
asked Ayasob, gazing in some trepidation at the landscape of monsters. Nail patted his shotgun. He looked at Ravana.
"What do you think? Is this a near miss, or did you get the door to find us water?"
"It's probably a coincidence," Ravana replied. "Let's try again." There was a soft, crumping boom of thunder, and it began to rain, a few large drops at first, and then a sustained torrential downpour of monsoon proportions. They were all drenched in an instant.
"That's fresh," Nail shouted.
He tilted his head back and opened his mouth.
"Throw 'em be, that's fresh."
Angharad and Ayasob were already drinking in the rain. Ayasob cupped her hands and lapped from them as they rapidly filled. With head tilted back, it was impossible not to drink down whole mouthfuls. Ravana opened the catchment vents on his chair and collected what water he could from the gullies of the hull. Even a little would help restore the fluid balance of his support systems. The rain stopped as quickly as it had begun. Nail wiped his hands across his wet face and laughed out loud.
"It was worth coming here after all," he said.
"I settle my mind for another attempt. I'm becoming increasingly fatigued. My concerns about my own deterioration are grave. I believe the support chair's damaged systems are shutting down, and without them, my life will become untenable. I have hidden this from the others, although I suspect Harlan has some idea. I focus on the door and on the key in Ayasob's hand. I wish I understood the arcane mechanisms of the 3-way door better, for blind meddling with such powerful artifacts is usually extremely inadvisable. I try to connect, anyway. I try to make the door, or some sentience beyond its physical substance, understand what I need from it. This time, I concentrate my thoughts on memories on the Arethusa. If there is a place I could wish us to be, it is there. I think of the Arethusa. I think of the year 404. Will it comprehend me? Will it be able to act upon that comprehension? I told it thirst, and it brought us to water, if only in the most tenuous sense. Open the door." A warm, dusty wind blew into their faces. A hard sun beat down from a cloudless sky. The door stood in a thicket of odd, twisted thorn brush, hard as bone and twice as tall as a fully grown man. The brush was gnarled and wrinkled, powder grey on its bark, and its thorns were long and sharp.
"Is this what you were trying for?" Nail asked.
"No," said Ravana, gliding out of the doorway behind him. "Not at all."
"We take a look around?" asked Nail. "Seeing as we're here?"
They moved away from the door, following the dusty slope up through the tangled brush. The wind was only light, but the brush seemed to move and creak around them.
"Not liking the plant life much," muttered Nail.
It's only plants, said Angharad. Plants cannot kill you.
Well, let me put the lie to that, Nail began. I was in this place once.
Shut up, said Ravener. He was so weary, it was an effort even to be polite. Disappointment was suffocating him.
What's that?
Asked Angharad, pointing ahead of them. They could glimpse some structure, like a derrick or a mast, rising from above the brush cover at the top of the slope.
Let's find out, said Nail. Look, ahead of us. The thorn scrub thins out.
They advanced, toiling up the slope, ducking under the spiked boughs. The thorn thicket came to an abrupt halt in a ragged line. Beyond it, the rising land had been cleared for several hundred meters. The earth looked scorched, as if flamers had been used to burn back the resilient brush.
Look at that, said Nail.
Clear of the scrub, they had a good view up the slope to the crown of the hill, where a drab, uninviting compound had been constructed. The compound was surrounded by a high security fence, and the summit of the hill had been entirely denuded of thorn brush within 300 meters of the fence line. Inside the fence lay a complex of modular buildings surrounding several tall masts. The masts were high-gain Vox antenna. The modular buildings were of a recognizably imperial template.
It's not home, but it's the best break we've had so far, Nail murmured.
We will approach? Asked Angharad. Yes, said Ravener. I'm reading human mind patterns, but they're oddly dulled. I can't fix numbers or much thought detail.
Why?
Asked Nail. I'm having trouble concentrating, said Ravener. I'm sorry.
Are you in pain, Gideon?
Nail asked. Let that be my problem, Harlan. The chair moved forwards. They began to follow it up the cleared slope. A voice suddenly rang out, distorted by Vox speakers, and stopped them in their tracks. Three humans were trudging up the slope behind them from the brush. They were male, clad in dusty guard-issue uniforms that had been heavily reinforced with chainmail and shielding plates. They wore heavy, full-visored helmets like pit fighters. The visor plates, like the shielding they wore, were scratched and shabby. All three of them were aiming heavy, dirty flamers.
Stay where you are,
ordered one of them. His voice crackled out of his helmet relay. He gestured with his flamer.
Where the hell did you come from?
Nail gestured honestly at the brush cover behind them.
Some kind of joker,
asked another of the men.
Where's your ship?
Demanded the leader.
We didn't see any ship coming. Where did you set down?
We didn't come in a ship, said Ravener through his voxponder. He was alarmed that he hadn't been forewarned of their approach, but much more alarmed that, now they were visible, he couldn't read their minds at all. The men stared at Ravener's chair.
What is that?
Asked the leader.
A support chair, said Nail. For a cripple?
Yes, said Ravener. The trio circled around them.
Let's lose the shotgun,
one told Nail. Nail tossed it to the dust, obligingly.
And the sword, you?
Another said to Angharad. The three men seemed particularly fascinated by the towering woman in her torn leather armor.
I will not draw it, for I have no intention of harming you, Angharad replied clearly, but I will not be divorced from Avisarex.
Ayasob jumped and squealed as the leader of the trio fired his flamer at the ground in a roaring gale of heat. Burned dust billowed up from the vitrified scorch mark.
Drop the bloody sword, the leader said.
Do it,
Nail hissed sidelong at Angharad.
I understand your code, woman, but we've come too far, and I mean too very far, for you to screw this up.
With an expression on her face like she was sawing off her own arm, Angharad unbuckled the steel's long case and lowered it respectfully into the dust.
Burn gang two chief to base,
they heard the leader Vox. Come back, BG-3, the link crackled.
Turn out a security squad to the main gates and meet us there. We're coming in. Tell the boss she won't believe what we've just found out here.
The room in the modular shelter was cool and quiet, air circulating through well-maintained vent systems. There was a steel table and half a dozen folding chairs. Nail sat down on one and sighed, bone-tired. Ayasob sat on the floor at his feet and curled up. Angharad paced. She was visibly agitated at having her steel taken from her against her will. Ravener lowered his chair onto the deck to conserve power and rested. Watching him,
Nail was concerned for his master's well-being. Fluid had begun to leak from the gouges in the chair again, and this time it was running dark and unclear, as if dirt or biological waste was mixing with the chair's circulation system. The trio of chain-mailed troopers had led them up to the compound gates, one of them lugging the shotgun and the sword. A squad of regular Imperial Guard had assembled to meet them. They carried Bull pup-format lasguns and wore more standard combat fatigues, lacking the mail and plate armor of the Flamer team. Nail hadn't been able to recognize the regimental insignia. The men wore helmets, but their faces were bare, except for dust goggles. They had stared in complete incomprehension at the prisoners being brought in. Nail had wondered if it was because of the odd mix of them, a towering Amazon with sullen eyes and leather bodywear ripped in places to reveal toned skin scabbed with scratches, a barely pubescent girl in a robe, a crippled freak in a floating chair, and a bald bruiser in body gloving that had seen better days. He had a nasty feeling they were simply baffled at seeing any visitors at all.
"I can't read any of them at all," Ravenna had sent. "Cough if you hear this, Nail."
Nail had coughed.
"Then my mind's not totally useless. They must be blocked."
The squad had brought them into the module chamber and locked the hatch. 10 minutes passed. Nail got up off his chair and moved to peer out of one of the small, recessed windows.
"Listening station, you think?" he asked.
"Yes,"
said Ravenna, his voice just a dry wheeze, like an asthmatic whisper.
"I thought so. From those masts. High security in places like this."
"You know the regiment flashes, by the way?"
"No,"
said Ravenna. Nail shrugged.
"Me neither. Are you sure you're coping, Gideon?"
"I have had better days. Listen to me. We may have walked into trouble here. A high security zone, as you said. I will try to talk us out of this, because it is our best chance of salvation. It is the only hope of escape the door has offered us so far. Imperial contact, please, follow my lead. Do not do anything provocative."
"Hey,"
said Nail, with an open-handed shrug.
"I meant Angharad specifically."
"I understand," the Carthayan snapped. "But Avisarex needs me, and—"
"Avisarex can sit and wait, Angharad. For throne's sake—"
Ravenna's voxponder suddenly cut off, and the monotone vox pattern was lost in a series of strangulated gulps and rattles. Nail hurried to the chair. He realized the sounds were coughing, or even choking.
"Gideon."
"What's wrong with him?" asked Angharad, with a tone that suggested she didn't really care how much Ravenna suffered.
"Frig, I don't know. I know he was hurt bad. Oh, throne."
Nail took a hand away from the chair's side. It was smeared with blood. Blood was weeping out of the puncture marks the hook-limbed monsters had punched into its casing.
"I think he's dying in there."
"You are quite probably correct."
"Gideon, I think we've known each other long enough for me to be honest with you, Harlan." "I would hope that to be true."
"I could put up a brave front and try to keep being the strong leader, but I'm not feeling so very strong anymore. My support systems are close to shutdown. When they are gone, my body will start to die. Furthermore, I believe I may have sustained physical injury. A wound, maybe more than one. I cannot tell, because my chair's medical supervision system has cut out. My voxponder also just malfunctioned. I am attempting system repairs to it."
"So I have to do the talking?"
"For now. These people seem blocked to my mind. That may be because of my reduced performance, but I think they're properly blocked. I need you to—"
"Shh," said Nail.
The chamber door had just opened. Two troopers entered, and were followed by a small brunette woman in the uniform of a guard colonel. She was strong-featured and almost attractive, although her face was lined and worn by years of care and sunlight. She gave a nod, and one of the troopers closed the door. The woman walked around and sat down behind the table. She regarded her four detainees.
"I can't read her either, Harlan. She's blocked too."
Nail rose from beside the chair and faced the seated woman.
"I'm sorry for this trouble, ma'am," he said. "My name is Harlan Nail. I am an accredited bounty hunter, carrying license to hunt in the Scarus
Electif, and Borodan sectors.
That's an interesting series of lies, the woman replied with a husky voice. Or at least unlikely, considering how far away those sectors lie.
May I ask, ma'am, where we are?
She hesitated with a confused smirk.
Are you telling me you don't know?
Would I ask such a stupid question if I did?
I suppose not. This is Rajez.
I don't know it.
Please, Harlan, be careful what you say.
I'm interested. How could you be on a world, asked the woman, without the slightest knowledge of where it is?
I could tell you a story about how I was kidnapped by slavers and made my escape along with these three companions, landing on a world I had no way of identifying.
Would that story be true? She asked, mildly.
Look at me. Look at the three people I'm traveling with. Are we remotely likely? Don't we look like escapees from a slaver ship?
That makes more immediate sense than the suspicions I have.
What might they be?
That you're spies. Good spies disguise themselves in the most unlikely ways, in my experience.
Nail nodded towards Angharad, aloof at the back of the room.
Look at her. Built for fighting. That's why the slavers chose her. Good breeding stock for the arenas.
I am not good breeding stock for...
Shut up, Angharad.
But the slavers, they obviously saw that in me, Angharad added.
Slavers? Asked the woman. We haven't had slaver activity since... When did we last have slaver activity in this sub, Curter?
Never,
answered one of the troopers.
Do spies just walk out into the open to get captured?
Asked Nail.
They might, the woman said. It rather depends on their agenda.
Nail shrugged and risked a smile at the woman.
This isn't going well, is it?
I'd say not, the woman rose. I'm obliged to tell you that I am Colonel Asa Lang, in operational command of this station, and that's all I am obliged to tell you. You are prisoners of war.
There's a war?
Oh, please, Lang replied.
Are you obliged to offer us aid?
Nail asked.
What kind of aid?
Water would be nice. We haven't had liquid in a while, or food. The kid there is suffering. Medicaid aid would be nice, too. My acquaintance, Gideon, there. He's been hurt.
Lang looked at the support chair.
He is a disabled person? In a support unit?
He's been stabbed.
By what?
Long story,
Nail began.
Harlan, just cut to the chase.
Nail nodded at Ravenna.
May I show you something, Colonel Lang?
He asked.
Go on.
He moved to the chair.
Don't get jumpy or trigger-happy now,
he added to the two troopers.
Hand it to me, Gideon.
The chair opened a mechanical slot on its nose and displayed Ravenna's inquisitorial rosette, the badge of special condition. Nail took it out and handed it to Lang.
This is Inquisitor Gideon Ravenna, of the Ordos Helican. The rest of us are part of his chosen company. We have been through a terrible experience that has deposited us here on your world. We request, by the authority of the Inquisition, your immediate help.
Lang handed the rosette to one of the troopers.
Get this checked, she said.
The man hurried out of the chamber.
If that claim is true, I apologize for your treatment.
She took out a link.
I need Medicaid Bashesvili standing ready in the infirmary quickly, and get someone to bring water and food.
Thank you, Colonel, said Nail. We...
How did you get here? Asked Lang.
Via a portal.
A what?
A portal.
I don't understand.
Neither do I, really. It's been rough, but that's why I want to know where we are.
This is Rajez, in the Phantomime subsector.
Phantomime? Throne. That's right out on the edge of the Ultima Segmentum.
If your story is more than a story, you're a long way from home, Lang replied. This is listening station Arethusa on...
What did you say?
Nail cut in, sharply.
That this is listening station Arethusa.
Nail looked at the chair.
You were aiming for the Arethusa, weren't you?
Yes, Harlan.
Shit,
Nail moaned.
That frigging door.
Who are you talking to? Asked Lang nervously. Are you talking to the cripple? Is he speaking?
My master Ravenna is a psyker, said Nail.
For some reason, he can't read you.
Lang nodded. It's because we're implanted with blockers when we do a tour here on Rajaz. The kukud screams when we burn it.
The what?
The thornweed. It grows very rapidly, and would choke the station if we didn't use the burn gangs to crop it back on a daily basis. But it is psi-active. At night, it whispers. When we kill it, it screams. The cumulative effect of either can be lethal. When we are sent here for a duty rotation, we are psychically blocked to preserve our sanity.
She leaned forwards and pulled back her hair to reveal the implant lodged in the base of her skull.
Unblocked, you will quickly start to suffer.
May I ask you another question?
Asked Nail. I suppose so,
Lang replied.
What year is this?
What?
What year is this? The calendar date?
Nail asked, looking her in the eyes.
It is 404, of course, she said. 404, point M40.
Chapter 8. The Arethusa was cold and forbidding when they came back from the surface. It had never been the most comfortable ship, nor the most welcoming, but as they stepped in through the air gate, it felt especially dank and stale. Unworth scampered ahead of them, excited.
Fiflank has fixated something, he exclaimed.
It had better be something good, Thonia said to the others. My mind is made up. It would take a lot to change it.
Wait to see what Unworth has found, said Kiss. If it's Siskin's ship.
If, echoed Thonius. I want a call set for Thracian by tonight.
Kiss and Kara waited while the others wandered despondently out of the dock bay.
Is Thracian such a good idea, Patience? Kara asked once the others were out of earshot.
The mercy of Lord Urokan.
Kiss shrugged.
It's Karl's call, Kar, and maybe he's right. We should try to make amends now he's gone.
Has he, though?
Kiss looked at her.
What do you mean?
Kara tilted her head.
Since when did Gideon ever not beat the odds?
Nice try, Kara Swole, Kiss replied. I'm afraid I just can't buy into that sort of optimism. I saw the witch house perish, and I saw how damaged he was. He's gone from us.
Kara sighed. Kiss felt how close to tears the smaller woman was.
It's been hard up here, Kara said.
What do you mean?
The ship's been misbehaving. On again, off again, while we were waiting for you. I didn't want to bother you with it, so I never sent.
How is the ship misbehaving?
Asked Kiss, quietly. Kara laughed humorlessly.
Oh, like it's haunted. The whole crew is spooked. No one can sleep, and we keep hearing sobbing.
I thought you'd look tired.
Tired?
Drained. Strung out.
Well, I am. Everyone aboard is, even before we heard what had happened.
So, sobbing?
Yes, and manic laughter, through the vox, even when it's shut down.
I don't sense anything, said Kiss, uncertainly, tentatively allowing her mind to reach out.
You will. You won't sleep. Or if you do, it won't be calm. That's why I said what I said about Gideon.
Explain.
Kara shrugged.
I thought it might be him. Somewhere. Trying to get through.
Let me look into it, said Kiss.
She had a distinct notion of what might be wrong, and there was no way she was going to scare Kara Swole with the idea yet.
Look, she said brightly. There's someone who loves you.
Kara turned around. Belknap was waiting for her in the arch of the main docking clamp. She crossed to him, and they hugged.
Is it true?
Belknap asked Kiss as she approached.
Is what true, Patrick?
He cleared his throat.
Is Ravana dead, Kiss?
Yes, I'm afraid he is, she replied.
Kiss strode into the infirmary ward. There was no sign of Frauke, except a dish full of low-stick butts and a forsaken data slate. Zale lay on the cot, thin and cold as ice.
Zale?
No response.
Zale.
She turned as Whiston Frauke re-entered the room behind her. He was dabbing his nose with a paper swab from the surgery.
Oh, you're back then? He asked.
Where were you?
Out there, Frauke gestured, meaning the surgery chamber. Don't often see you down here.
I didn't realize I needed an appointment, she snapped.
Steady, he soothed. Listen, I heard what happened. I'm sorry. Truly. She stared at him. She was aware that a rising tide of grief was making her irritable and short-fused.
Has he woken?
Zael, no.
And you'd tell me if he had.
No, I keep it a secret, Frauke retorted, sitting down on his chair.
What is this? Kara told me the ship has been troubled while we were away.
Frauke blew up his cheeks and exhaled a sort of resigned sigh.
So I've heard. Not felt anything yourself?
I'm an untouchable baby.
I'd appreciate it if you kept the pet names to yourself. Have you experienced any of the phenomena the others have reported?
No, he said. He sat down and reached for a low stick, but didn't light it. Untouchable though he was aware of the tension in the room. They've told me things. Sobbing on the Vox. Bogwin was in the galley last night, and he heard laughter coming out of plumbing. Fivelang says he hears footsteps following him every time he takes a stroll along the holds. Other stuff. I don't know, Kiss. Show me a ship that isn't full of noises. The crew's agitated, especially now they know he's not coming back. Imagination does stuff to you.
But you've heard nothing.
No.
And Zael hasn't woken, even for a moment.
Frauke met her eyes. I know what's at stake, Kiss. And you know the damned responsibility Ravenna handed me. You think I like that? You think I'd lie to you?
I don't know. Truth is, Frauke, none of us know you very well at all. We can't read you.
Story of my life. You have no idea whatsoever how hard it is to be an untouchable. Everyone feels the absence, and it makes them uncomfortable. You get treated like shit. Working for Ravenna's the only decent job I've ever had. The only time I've felt worth anything. I guess that's over now, isn't it? Get off my back. I've covered yours long enough, and I deserve more respect, even if I make you uncomfortable. They stared at each other. On a different day, under different circumstances, she might have been more sympathetic. In his own alien fashion, Whiston Frauke had saved them more times than she could count. He certainly deserved their respect, but just then she felt unable to give it. She was too scared.
Where were you?
She asked. When?
When I came in here.
Back there, said Frauke defensively. Like I said.
Why?
I was looking for a swab. I had a nosebleed.
A nosebleed?
Yes, I had a nosebleed.
Only one? Kiss asked,
glancing down at several blood-soaked swabs littering the floor under Zael's cot. She looked up again slowly and stared at Frauke.
Nosebleeds, secondary indicative symptom of proximal psychic activity.
Or of picking your nose, Frauke snapped. I'm an untouchable, remember?
He's awake, though, isn't he?
Kiss asked, looking back at Zael. I'd have sensed it.
Sensed it?
Blocked it, I mean.
You know what he is, what he could be.
I'm very aware of what he might be, Mamsel Kiss. Kiss lunged at Frauke and dragged him out of the chair. The bedside cabinet crashed over, spilling Frauke's dish of low stick butts and his data slate onto the deck. He cried out in surprise and tried to fight her off. He was strong and large, but she was determined, and she was a trained principal agent of the Inquisition. She outclassed him many times over. She slammed Frauke back into the wall and pinned him, her forearm across his throat.
Why? Why are you doing this?
He gasped.
You tell me why, she hissed.
She reached out with her telekinesis, still pinning him physically, and pulled the auto pistol out of his pocket. It floated up beside their faces.
I know why you have this. You know why you have this. Ravenna trusted you.
Kiss!
He woke up, didn't he? He's awake. That's why the ship is sobbing out of its decks. What's the matter, Frauke? Too pussy to do it.
No!
Frauke yelled. Kiss stepped away and shoved Frauke away onto the deck. He fell awkwardly. She turned and grabbed hold of the floating pistol, racking the slide with her mind. Kiss stepped forwards. She aimed the pistol at Zael's head with a steady, two-handed grip.
I'm sorry, she said.
Frauke crashed into her and brought her down hard. They wrestled on the floor. The weapon went off, and the slug tore into the ceiling. Belknap burst into the infirmary. Without hesitation, he dived at the pair of them. Guard training took over, and he managed to pull them apart.
Get off!
Belknap shouted, pushing Frauke away. Frauke bashed into the wall and sat down heavily. He blinked, dazed at Belknap, fighting brutally to contain Kiss. Kiss had caught the doctor in a telekinetic hold and was lifting him away from her. Frauke reached up and turned off his limiter. Belknap crashed down onto Kiss. They rolled, slamming into the legs of Zale's cot. Belknap headbutted Kiss in the nose and, as she floundered, pincered her in a secure restraint hold.
"Get off me!" Kiss howled, blood dribbling from her nostrils. "Get off me, you bastard, or so help me!"
"Drop it!" Belknap ordered, tightening his hold. He pinched at the soft pressure points and then yanked Kiss's hand back and squeezed until she let go of the gun. It clattered onto the decking.
"Not in my damn infirmary," he snarled. "Never in my place of care. You don't do this."
"He's slight," Kiss screamed, struggling back. "We have to kill him before—"
"Not in here, ever,"
said Belknap firmly. He forced one of his knees forwards to pin her right forearm and then, reluctantly, chopped a punch into Kiss's spinal nerve cluster. Kiss blacked out and went limp.
"Get Kara down here," he told Frauke.
"What the frig were you thinking of, you daft ninka?" Kara asked. She came into the little holding tank in the Arethusa's brig block where Kiss was sprawled. Whiston Frauke, diligently smoking a low stick, hovered in the doorway behind her.
"I was thinking about keeping all of us alive, Kara," Kiss replied, rolling over and sitting up. "Let me out of here."
"I can't."
"Why?"
"You tried to murder Zale."
"He's not Zale, he's Slight."
Kara shook her head.
"Your boyfriend's a tough bastard,"
Kiss said, rubbing her neck.
"He doesn't mess around."
"He's not my boyfriend," said Kara.
"What is he, then?"
"My lover. Boyfriend is a stupid word."
"Whatever he is, he smacked me up. Very gentlemanly. I would have been impressed if I wasn't spark out. Fancy moves, if you're easily impressed by a man beating a woman. He ever do that to you, Kara?"
"Stop it."
"Thing is," Kiss said quietly, "he should have let me do it."
"Murder Zale. A helpless kid."
"Not so helpless. He's a demon, and he's waking up."
"Why are you saying this, Patience?"
"You know why, Kara. Gideon told us. Slight could be sleeping in that boy's body."
"Could" being the operative word. "You went crazy."
"Come on. That's why Gideon set Frauke to watch him and told him to shoot the boy if he ever woke up."
"What?"
asked Kara, recoiling.
"It's true. Ask the frigging blunter yourself."
"Hello? Standing in the room? In earshot?" Frauke remarked.
"Is this true?"
Kara asked him.
"Oh, of course not," said Frauke.
"Liar," Kiss said. "Gideon told me."
"Patience,"
Kara shushed.
"It's not a lie," said Frauke.
"Kara, he's tainted. He's no longer secure," Kiss cried desperately. "Frauke is suffering nosebleeds."
"It's congenital," said Frauke.
"Screw congenital," said Kiss. "He's impaired. Zale's psychic force has penetrated him. Wake up, Kara. The blunter safeguard is compromised. The boy is stirring. The frigging ship is haunted. Gideon told me to watch for this."
"And execute the teenage boy."
Kara turned away. "Sholto has a fix on what he believes is the allure. We are trying to talk Carl into pursuing it. I wish I had your backing on that, Patience, but you're messed up, I'm sorry." She left the tank. The door slammed shut, and the lock turned.
"Kara!"
Kiss screamed. "Well, that was unpleasant," Frauke said as he walked down the brig block hallway with Kara. She paused and looked around at him.
"If it turns out there's any truth in what she said, Whiston, I will gut you myself. That's a promise."
"Fair play," he replied. "But I'm telling the truth." Kara nodded.
"I've got to get upstairs."
"Are we going after this allure, then?" Frauke asked.
"I hope so."
There was a long, awkward pause as they faced one another. "Well, it's been pleasant chatting," Frauke said, and turned. She watched him walk away down the companionway. Kara headed for the bridge. Most of the crew had assembled on the bridge deck. A few looked up as Kara walked in. Sholto Unworth was in his command seat, studying several consoles of flickering data. Belknap was waiting by the main entry hatch, He stopped Kara and held her for a moment.
"I didn't enjoy that," he said quietly. "Kiss is your friend. Mine too, I thought. But she was just crazy. I had to stop her. I've never seen..." "It's all right," Kara replied. "Kiss has been through a lot. You did what you had to do."
"What's the matter?"
"With me? Nothing. Something at the back of my mind. Still, I'll get over it."
She broke from him and walked down onto the main bridge deck of the Arethusa.
"Sholto."
Unworth looked up from his consoles.
"Is Patience all right?"
he asked. "She's fine. What have you got?"
"A strengthy lead," Unworth replied. "We have been able to fixate a vehicle pattern on that yonder. I'm plucking it up for you now."
Graphic display detail lit up on the main viewer. The digitally enhanced plot of one of the 60 starships at high anchor over Utokri. "That's the Allure?" she asked.
"It took a good deal of fidgetation to locate,"
Unworth replied. "But it's the Allure."
"I would staple my life on it," said Unworth. "It's displaying alternating running codes and signals, but its inheritable pattern is that of the Allure."
"Current situation. It's taking on supplies from service boats prior to disembarkation," said Plankton. "How long before it breaks anchor?"
6 hours. 8, maybe," Plankton said.
Kara nodded. She turned and looked at the pale man standing by the main viewer, a gale-wee throw draped around his hunched shoulders.
"Carl."
Thonius turned to look at them.
"What do you want me to say, Kara?"
"We don't have the manpower or the firepower to board or seize them. They're 3 times our displacement."
"We're just going to let them go?" she asked.
Thonius shrugged.
"I'd love to bring them down, but I don't see how."
"A stealth boarding raid," suggested Balak. 2 or 3 gigs with muzzled drives."
"A lovable conception," said Unworth. "Except for the veritable factor that the Arethusa doesn't have 2 or 3 gigs. It doesn't even have 1. We have 2 cargo landers, and that's the summation. Neither are muzzleable."
Fiflank nodded.
"See," said Thonius, "there's nothing we can do."
"Except watch them translate away," said Balak.
"Thrown, Carl.
That ship is our last lead to Moloch."
Thonius sighed.
"I'm tired of hunting Moloch. I say we lay course for Thracian Primaris now and get the unpleasantness over with."
"We could, in all benediction, follow them," said Unworth quietly.
"Follow a ship through the warp?" Thonius scoffed. "I knew you were short, Unworth. I didn't realize you were also short on brains. We could translate after them, but after that, in the Immaterium..."
"That was not my meaning," said Unworth. "We could follow them, if we knew where they were going."
"There's a sort of brilliant, simple logic to that," said Kara.
"Oh yes, let's give the shipmaster a big round of applause," said Thonius.
"Don't mock, Carl," said Kara.
"Please," Thonius retorted.
"Do I actually have to remind you that we don't know where they are going? Which largely clobbers the brilliant, simple logic out of Unworth's idea."
"They know where they're going," said Plighton, nodding at the screen plot.
"Well, of course they do," replied Thonius.
"Right now," Plighton pressed quietly, "they'll have chosen a heading, begun stellar translation computations, started the disembarkation rituals. The navigator will already be focusing and preparing, readying himself for the trials of the Empyrean."
"So if somebody got aboard," said Kara, "say, via a service boat..."
"Oh, no," said Thonius.
"No, no, no."
"Carl," Kara began.
"Please, Carl,"
said Balak.
"I think it's worth a try."
"It would be suicide," said Thonius. "Even if a person could get aboard and stay out of sight and harm's way, even if that person could identify the destination and signal the information, they would never get out again."
"If I got in," said Kara, "I'd get out."
"If it was you,"
said Balak.
"However, I'm volunteering."
"Wait a minute," objected Plighton. "I called it."
"No one called it," Thonius snapped. "No one's going."
"One last try, Carl," Kara said. "For Gideon's sake. One last try to find Moloch and finish him."
Thonius didn't reply. He stared at the deck and shrugged. "You're mad," he said. "I'm not mad," said Kara. "But I am going." She looked at Pleiton and Balak. "Sorry, no arguments. Only one of us three has been on that vessel before. Someone get a lander prepped for me, quickly." Kara walked back to the hatchway where Belknap was standing.
"I'm not very happy about this," he said quietly. "Thonius is right. This is suicide. There are too many risks and too many variables."
"I'm sorry," she said.
"I knew you wouldn't like it. But this is what I do."
"Kara, the risks."
She smiled at him and made the sign of the Aquila.
"Have faith," she said.
Frauke walked back into the infirmary and righted his chair. He sat down.
"Thank you."
"For what?"
"Protecting me."
"I don't know why I did. I don't know anything anymore."
"But you can hear me."
"Yes, that still bothers me. I shouldn't be able to."
"No, you shouldn't. I think the time's coming when you won't be an untouchable anymore. I've burnt you out. I've made you touchable. I'm sorry about that."
"I know this is all wrong. I know you've screwed up my head. You made me lie."
"Not really."
"I should tell someone."
"No."
Frauke blinked and seemed to find focus for a second. Fear crossed his face.
"Throne, I know what you're doing to me."
"Stop it. For Throne's sake, you made me lie. You made me lie to them. To Kiss and Swole and..."
"Quiet, Whiston."
"I will not be quiet." He rose to his feet and scrabbled for the wall link. "I need to..."
"Sit down. You need to sit down and be quiet. We're not there yet."
Frauke lowered his hand and sat down, obediently. His eyes were blank.
Yes, he said. "Sit down. That's a good idea."
He picked up his data slate.
"Where were we?" "She was gasping in gleeful pleasure as he took her. Whiston?"
"Yes?"
"Your nose is bleeding."
Frauke looked down at the spots of blood plipping onto his shirt front. "Damn, my nose is bleeding."
"Get a swab."
"I'll get a swab," he said, rising up out of the chair. Kiss crouched against the door of the brig tanker, her ear to the lock. Once again, she tried to kine her way through the tumblers and align them so that the bolt would slide. Ravener himself had inscribed the tumblers with wards to make it hard for a psyker to manipulate them the day that he had taken over the Arethusa. There was a clunk. The door remained in place. She cursed aloud and placed her ear back against the keyhole.
"Kiss."
Patience lurched back.
"Hello?"
There was silence. Her imagination. She leaned back to try again.
"Kiss."
"Throne." She pulled back and scrambled away from the door on her backside.
"Who is that? Who is that?"
"It's me, Kiss. It's me."
She swallowed.
"Gideon?"
"It's me, Kiss. I'm just here, on the other side of the door."
"The door?"
Kiss hurried back to the lock and examined it.
"Gideon?"
"Still here, Kiss. But so far away. It feels like 1,000 years. I am so trapped, so lost. I want to be there."
"Gideon, great throne, you're alive!"
There was a long silence.
"Gideon!"
"Kiss, I lost you there. I'm weak, so very weak. I lost you there. For a moment. Are you still there?"
"Yes, I am."
She pressed her cheek harder to the cold steel door, listening at the keyhole.
"Gideon? Gideon?"
"I'm here, but I'm so far away. I want to be there. I'm hurt. I'm locked in. The door won't open."
"I'm trying to open it."
Kiss fell back, panting with the effort.
"I want to be with you, Kiss. I can feel it coming. I'm weak. I don't know what to do."
"What's coming?"
Death. I can feel it. It's coming. I can taste it. It wants me. It wants to take me. I've been keeping it at bay, fending it off, but I can't much longer.
How can I help you? She said.